They call themselves the sensitives. Millions of people around the world who get headaches, fatigue, rashes, and other maladies from the more than 85,000 synthetic chemicals we come into contact with in our daily lives. For most of us, laundry detergents or air fresheners are benign. And although health organizations around the world are not in agreement about whether or not environmental illness is a biological or psychological disorder, journalist Oliver Brody found a group of people for whom this syndrome is very real. His new book takes us inside the world of people who seem to be allergic to the modern world. It's called The Sensitives, The Rise of Environmental Illness and the Search for America's Last Pure Place. Hi there, Oliver.
Hi there.
How did your interest in this topic begin?
I've been living with an awareness of chemicals in the environment for some time, but it was always in sort of a peripheral way, this awareness. You know, every now and then they get a news item about some chemicals in your food, or there's antifreeze in your whiskey, or phthalates in your Kraft mac and cheese. And I was living a kind of life where I would log these little alarms and not really ever know what to do with them. I think that everyone sort of puts together a little plan for themselves to the best of their ability. We know that pesticides are pretty much everywhere, so we buy organic food. But really, there's ultimately not a whole hell of a lot you can do. This is just the world that we happen to live in, nor can you ever really be sure what the threat is, because it's kind of hard to nail down what the true dangers are, just because everything is so ambient. So when I ran across this group of people, it seemed to be an opportunity to consider the possibility that maybe, like, what if everything that we have contact with on a daily basis really is as terrifying and as dangerous as we might fear? How then would that change our lives? How then would that change our perspective on government regulation, on the medical establishment, and all these other institutions that we rely upon to basically frame our reality for us?
So these people, the sensitives, what are some of the things that trigger them, and how does that exposure affect them?
Well, it could be anything in terms of the trigger. It could be hairspray or perfume or that new car smell. Could be ice cream with preservatives even. It really depends. Usually it'll start off either with one big exposure, like a chemical spill at work, for instance, or a years long exposure to, there's one woman I ran across who worked in the fields picking strawberries when she was younger. And so her theory was that over the years, this the pesticides kind of built up within her system until it reached some kind of a tipping point. So in terms of the symptoms, the most common symptoms are fatigue, brain fog, muscle aches, memory difficulties. There's one guy who said that it's a bit like being pregnant, except after 9 months, it just keeps going.
And is the hypervigilance that a lot of us have been experiencing about what we touch and who we come into contact with in the COVID-19 world, is that sort of a small window into the way that sensitives live their lives all of the time?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's actually even more than that, in the sense that, before COVID, I think that this population had kind of a freak show quality. I think that people were fascinated by them. And it was a little sort of patronizing and insulting, this attitude that the general public had towards sensitives, because they're just seen as weirdos. Their behavior is often rather weird, at least the more extremely affected. They're doing things like hanging mail on the clothesline to dry and so on. But I know people now who do much the same, like they'll buy groceries and they'll just set them aside for like a day or two until they unpack them. So in a way, I think that we often have this kind of this perspective on people who are different from us. But in a way, I also think that it speaks to how we use these people as a way to kind of understand our own fears. Like subconsciously, I think that all of us might be frightened of the chemical world that we live in, but it's a little too frightening to take it, to consider that literally. But what you can do is sort of spectate on the lives of others. And the same is true, the same phenomenon I think happened with preppers. over the last 10 or 15 years. I'm not sure if the term is used in New Zealand, yeah. but preppers being those who are basically expecting the end of the world at any moment. And so, you know, spend most of the time stockpiling cans of beans and munitions. Mm-hmm. So, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, these people were looked on as freaks. But these days, you know, it's kind of like, geez, you know, maybe I could use a few extra cans of beans.
One person you talked to said that he wished he'd gotten cancer instead, because at least then people would have believed him. More than 50 million people say they have health issues related to chemical exposure. I guess logic would tell us that they can't all be wrong.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, they're not wrong about their own suffering. Suffering is real. So, you know, whether it can be traced to some unique biological substrate at some point becomes kind of academic, or perhaps even pedantic. I think that there is a natural defensiveness, a weird sort of unexpected defensiveness in the scientific and the medical establishment to dismiss stuff that they don't understand, because in a way it's an indictment of the ignorance of experts. So, you know, we can't possibly be wrong, because what would that say about us? We're supposed to be the authorities. Mm. So there's a tendency to dismiss it from the very people you would expect to be most open to the possibility that there's something that they still don't know. So it's kind of a paradoxical twist on the way things work out. As for you know, this gentleman's remark that he wished he'd gotten cancer, I guess I would say that the more I looked into this subject, the more my interest switched a little bit and turned into sort of an exploration of the nature of suffering. Because you have to understand the suffering that these people experience is in many cases just profound. So there are millions and millions of people who experience some form of sensitivity, but it's a gradation. So on the one hand, you have someone who might just be sensitive to perfume, gives them a headache. But there are, at the very extreme end, people who are basically exiled from their lives. You know, they can't tolerate their homes anymore. And so they go moving from one place to the next. The term for these people in their own community is runners, just searching for some place on earth where they can feel normal. And often in the course of doing this, they may lose the faith and understanding of their loved ones, not to mention the medical community. So they're very much on their own. And it's, I think, rather not unlike living on a totally alien planet, which helps explain why the rate of suicide in this community is unusually high.
Yeah, you write that the anecdotes carried a whiff of madness, yet the distress the sensitives expressed was clearly real. We've actually been talking about unintended consequences of chemicals since Silent Spring. Rachel Carson in 1962, she was talking about the use of DDT, but now in 2020, how ubiquitous is our exposure to chemicals?
Well, I mean, you cited some nice stats in the beginning that there's something like 85,000 untested synthetic chemicals in our environment. And it's important to note that they're not just untested individually, but they're untested in combination. So if there's 85,000 individual ones, how many possible combinations are there? Mm. So in a way, it's a regulatory failure. But on the other hand, like, what kind of regulatory would you have to a mechanism would you need to have in order to test that many? It's just impossible. So there's no doubt that we live in sort of a chemically flooded environment. Something like 4 billion pounds of chemicals are dumped every year into the environment annually. That's just the United States. And meanwhile, the size of the chemical industry has tripled between 2004 and 2013. And just for reference, I think it's something like you need little more than 1/70th of a teaspoon of mercury in a 25-acre lake to render the fish unsafe to eat. So very, very small amounts of chemicals are enough to throw things way off. And there's a lot of chemicals out there. So that's one side of things. The other side is we are seeing, and there's also no doubt about this because I looked very carefully at these statistics because I didn't want to be in any way alarmist, because there's a lot of sort of alarmist literature out there, and I didn't want any of that bullcrap. I was trying to keep it as real as I possibly could. So what's very real and true is that thyroid and liver cancer rates are up 30% between 1975 and 2014. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, kidney cancer, up 200%. Autism, up 220% between 2000 and 2017, and on, intellectual impairment, allergic sensitivity. There's one alarming study that came out a couple of years ago that I'm sure many of your listeners are aware of about sperm counts in men down by 50% in the last 40 years. Nobody knows why, but what else could it be? You know, there is the suspicion, and people who do these studies will say this, that there is a suspicion that this is linked to chemicals. But again, because chemicals are so ambient, it's impossible to make any really definitive conclusions.
And we should point out that not all chemicals are bad. We make medicines from chemicals. We use chemicals to keep our car running, or keep our home warm and dry. So it's not the existence of chemicals, it's just the untested nature of some of them, right?
Well, certainly, I mean, it's part of this gets down to the deal that we with the devil that we've made in terms of progress. So, you know, as you say, thousands and thousands of wonderful things have come of chemicals. But it's something about the way that we progress as a civilization, which is, you know, more or less blindly stumbling forward, doing the best we can. We like new stuff. We like inventing stuff. We like convenience. We like new products. You know, chemicals started with the dye industry, and actually it started the way I tell the story. It started with a cotton industry because there's a cotton boom in the mid-1800s, and that led to the sudden availability of cheap clothes. But we are still using natural dyes at the time, and you know, you need to crush something like 4,000 pounds of lichens or whatever to you know, dye the hem of a single garment. It just wasn't going to work. So you know, accidentally, synthetic color was discovered, and the chemical boom began with the making of dyes. And it was only after that that the medical pharmaceutical industry grew out of dyes, as did plastics and all the other stuff leading into the 20th century. So all this stuff has brought wonderful things as well as terrible things. I mean, if you think about the chemicals use in World War II, but this is one of the most basic and probably unanswerable questions at the bottom of civilization is how what are you supposed to do here? I mean, we're not going to, you know, like back in the very beginning of this, I think it was the late 1800s, someone wrote to, I think it was a London Times saying, you know, these chemicals are nice, but I've got this weird rash on my leg. And the editor of the paper wrote back saying, we're not going back. You know, we can't, it's, I'm sorry about your rash, but we're not going back. So I come back to, there's this comment by this guy who was a friend of Einstein back in the day, Heinrich Zeiner. And he pioneered statistical analysis of the effects of chlorine gas on the human body. This was in the wake of World War II. So he's one of the founders of probabilistic toxicology. And his point was that technology has to keep one step ahead of the risks that technology itself has created. So this is one way of framing the problem. Has technology done that? And or even if you can't answer that, you can always say, well, to what extent, like, are we getting worse at it? Are we falling behind? And this was something that Rachel Carson picked up on back in whatever, 1961 or something, you know, with chemicals, with DDT, and also nuclear power. Like, suddenly the risks are getting pretty fierce. And at what point are we going to stop being able to protect ourselves from the risks that we ourselves create? I don't know.
I'm speaking with journalist Oliver Brody, whose book is called The Sensitives, The Rise of Environmental Illness and the Search for America's Last Pure Place, Environmental Illness, or EI. After the Gulf War, some soldiers came back with similar symptoms to EI, Oliver, and there was a bit of research into the chemicals they'd been exposed to on the battlefield. Did it yield any definitive or useful results?
Well, the last I checked, I forget the scientific body. It's been a while, forgive me, but there's like maybe the National Academy of Science or something. They were kicking out reports every year on Gulf War illness. And Gulf War illness is great for one thing. They get funding. Like, it's if it's going to happen to soldiers, then it's something that needs to be funded. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of funding that was thrown at Gulf War research. And in the end, the conclusion was, this isn't real. And part of the reason for the conclusion was that people who hadn't even been deployed to the battlefield were coming down with symptoms. At the same time, they acknowledged that it wasn't possible to be really definitive about this for the same reasons that it was impossible in everyday life, because the chemicals that were used in the Iraq war were again, they're circumambient. So, you know, they're the oil fields and the chemical weapons. There's really no way to definitively trace the symptoms to the cause. So there's still kind of a big question mark over the whole thing. So I don't know. I mean, there's in a way, there's sort of like a family of these diseases that no one can quite make sense of. Fibromyalgia is another, chronic fatigue syndrome. They have a lot in common. And if I were to say what's in common, what they do have in common, it's their complexity. And we have a medical system, and I guess a scientific system as well, that is used to understanding things by isolating them and looking at them individually. So, you know, holistic medicine has made some headway in kind of a dialectical, by way of dialectical response to this tendency of expertise to isolate. But still, I don't think that we have come to some understanding of how to look at this stuff. The jury's out.
Yeah, people might be familiar with some of those syndromes or diseases that you're talking about. The difference here is, as you point out in your book, that EI is underreported. It impacts four times as many people as those diseases, and that those suffering from EI attribute their suffering to a specific cause. And some of them have found each other. Some of them have retreated to a town called Snowflake, Arizona, in the Southwest, where sensitives flock. How did that place become a magnet for them?
Right. Well, I think that if you're suffering, one thing that a doctor can do for you is give the imprimatur of his expertise and basically say, yeah, I hear you. You're suffering and it's legit. So that was not being said to this community of people. And you don't really understand like how much that's really necessary and that's really needed to feel heard and understood until that is withheld from you. So I think as a consequence, what ended up happening, and this is maybe one of the great things and often one of the horrible things about the internet, is that it allowed people to connect and to form communities and to start relying on each other. So great in the sense that people were able to get the support that they need. Maybe not so great in that sometimes these little communities can turn into echo chambers and can become a little weird. Anyway, Snowflake, the existence of Snowflake preceded a lot of those online communities. It was started by a guy who he was one of these guys who had there was some kind of industrial solvent spill at his workplace, and he withdrew to Snowflake. The appeal being that this is in just kind of like the outback, as it were, of eastern Arizona, totally isolated, 6,000 feet above sea level, very dry air, sparse vegetation, no pollution, and cheap. You know, no one wants to live there, so you can get like an acre for $300. So he moved there, and word eventually got out. And one activist-y type woman ended up settling there, and she kind of spread the word even more. So, you know, people who are desperate will do desperate things. And many of them just showed up on her driveway. She'd let them camp there until they could find a house of their own. So eventually this little community grew up.
And to give us an idea of the sorts of people who end up in Snowflake, Arizona, great name, by the way, can you tell us a bit of Brian's story?
Brian. Well, Brian, he didn't end up in Snowflake, but he was sort of the reason that I started doing this research in a way. I was looking into this whole community for a while and naturally drawn to the more extremely afflicted. And Brian, he was more sort of an online person, and he had kind of a leadership role in this online community in the sense that he was a great writer. So he was able to express a lot of the despair that people were feeling. And the way I saw it, he was almost like a pastor. In fact, a lot of his writings were religiously informed, but he helped people express their feelings and helped them feel heard, I think. And then one day he vanished, and there was concern in this online community that he might have killed himself, because that happens frequently. So I decided that I'd go and try to find him. You know, I had his last known location, which is I think on the northern rim of the Grand Canyon, just way out in the middle of nowhere. And I also knew a guy who was going to be passing through there, another sensitive who was in Aspen at the time and who's headed for L.A., one of these runner types who kind of kept a normal life going, but basically did so by endlessly circling around the United States in his Range Rover, never really stopping anywhere for long. So we went in search of him, and the hope was to find him eventually. But he was one of these more extremely affected types, and that's definitely the type that you found in Snowflake, people who just couldn't exist anywhere else. There was a guy I ran across who was typical of this category of extremely affected people. He said, the only place that I can exist in peace is halfway up Mount McKinley. So, again, it's like living on an alien planet.
Finally, you write about the lack of regulation and oversight in the US over chemicals in the environment. But is that the real problem? I mean, would you ever be able to regulate enough for people like the ones you were describing?
Well, I think that you probably couldn't do a worse job than what's being done now. I mean, we have a president who came in saying that he was going to put the regulations industry out of business. This was his ambition. So, and sure enough, he comes in and he removes a ban on all lobbyists working for government agencies that they lobbied in the past 2 years. So basically creates a revolving door between industry and government. Then he assigns a guy who used to work for the fossil fuel industry to head the APA, and a guy who was the head of 8 different pharmaceutical companies to head the FDA. So you couldn't do worse. But it's a good question. Like, is there anything that we could do? And I tried to kind of wrap my mind around this question, and the only way that I was able to do so is by putting it into some kind of historical perspective. And this gets a little bit back to the Rachel Carson stuff and how the world and the risks that we're living with have gradually changed over time. The short story is that it hasn't always been like this, but the risks have changed fundamentally in their nature. And I lean heavily in the book on this this writer, Ulrich Beck, who in 1992 wrote this book called Risk Society. And his premise was that was just this, that risk had changed in this very fundamental way, whereas before it was kind of closed and local. Now it was more global and open. And the example he liked to give was Chernobyl. And the quote I always remember is that the injured of Chernobyl today have not even been born. Mm-hmm. So, you've got a risk that is not contained by the country in which, this accident happened. It's not contained within the generation of people who are alive even when it happened. And finally, there is no institution on earth that is capable of really intelligently managing this risk. So, over time, I think that we have come to accept that there are some risks that we're just going to have to live with because this is a world that we've created for ourselves. And I like to point to this one report that came out in 1975 called the Rasmussen Report. This was a reactor safety study. And these studies were at that time, they started to be required by the government. In fact, it was a little bit before that. But one of the things that jumps out in the study is as the writer is trying to put the risk of nuclear meltdowns in perspective, he says, sure, there's always a danger that you could get wiped out by a nuclear meltdown, but keep in mind that that's 6 orders of magnitude less likely than dying in a car accident. So, and he had a list of these other dangers or threats, and, one was much less than the other. And so once you start looking at it relatively, eventually you can say, well, I can live with that so long as it's, 6 times less likely than dying in a car accident or 4 times less likely than, dying by slipping on a bar of soap. I suppose I could live with that. But there's been this kind of slow encroachment. So the risks have gotten greater and greater, and there's less and less that we can do about them. And, nuclear war is obviously the last one that we've been through. And that's, unexpectedly faded away, and it's replaced by others. So we have created this world, and I think it's up to us to decide what kind of world we want to live in the future and start actively advocating for it, as opposed to just responding to the one that happens to develop around us.
Thank you for writing the book. It's called The Sensitives, The Rise of Environmental Illness and the Search for America's Last Pure Place. Journalist Oliver Brody, really appreciate your time today. Cheers.
My pleasure.